I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Programs on WILL AM are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, welcoming Cirque El Waz, Nebbia. On March 3rd and 4th, they return to Champaign-Urbana with acrobatics and theatrics in the third part of the Sky Trilogy. More information is available online at KrannertCenter.com.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. You'll find us at 580 AM and 90.9 FM, as well as online at will.illinois.edu. Well, are you keeping up on the avalanche of news stories alleging corruption at the highest levels of Illinois government? What about the stories of ethical lapses in criminal conduct uncovered recently in the world of business? Well, today we're going to turn our gaze to what we may see as small transgressions. We'll talk about the ethical dilemmas of our everyday lives. Our guest is Clinton Corver. He is the co-author with Ronald Howard of Ethics for the Real World, Creating a Personal Code to Guide Decisions in Work and Life. The authors describe the book as a self-help guide. To quote them, they say, "The gist is this: we must master ethical distinctions to enable clear ethical thinking. We must commit in advance to ethical principles, and we must exercise disciplined decision-making skills to choose wisely." Our guest, Clinton Corver, is an entrepreneur. He is founder and CEO of Decision Street, which builds web-based tools to help consumers make sound decisions about health, wealth, housing, and family affairs. He has also taught ethical decision-making at Grinnell College. Listeners, you can join our discussion this afternoon. I look forward to your questions and comments. Join us with a phone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. WILL. Again, our guest, Clinton Corver, is the co-author with Ronald Howard of Ethics for the Real World, Creating a Personal Code to Guide Decisions in Work and Life. His co-author, Ronald Howard, is on the faculty of Stanford University School of Engineering, where he directs the department's Decisions and Ethics Center. Their book, Ethics for the Real World, is published by the Harvard Business Press. They also have a website. You'll find them online at www.ethicsfortherealworld.com. Again, the phone numbers, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Clinton Corver, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Celeste, it's a pleasure to be on your show.
Well, thanks so much. One of the statements that comes through loud and clear from the get-go in this book, ethics not only shapes character, it influences relationships. What impacts do ethical lapses have on character and our relationships with others?
Well, I think the relationship aspect of ethics is one of the most overlooked and, unfortunately, one of the most painful often. In that a lot of times when people will tell a white lie or they will do something that, you know, is almost ethical, what they don't appreciate is how that impacts the person on the receiving end of the lie and how that affects the kind of relationship that they can have with that person going forward.
Can you give us an example?
Well, so there's a a number of examples. You look in the popular press right now with, you know, Madoff and Stanford Financial Group and Mark Dreyer and all these sorts of folks. It's like, I mean, this is kind of obvious, but it's going to be pretty hard for these folks to get folks to invest with them anymore. That's at a very high level.
Yeah.
Now, if you get at a very sort of a low level, in not a low level, but sort of the everyday level. So when your mother asks you, do you think I look fat in this dress?
Mm-hmm.
So the standard response would be, well, let's say she does for the moment. The standard response would be, well, there's some white lie you can tell there to avoid hurting her feelings.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem with that is you have now, your mother probably isn't really asking you if she's fat or not. There's probably something else going on. And by telling the white lie, you avoid the possibilities of having an authentic interaction in that moment.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the, and this is also one of the opportunities in these ethically sensitive situations, there are often opportunities to deepen a relationship with someone. And if you take the easy way out, say with a white lie, what you do is you not only miss that opportunity, but you begin to erect a barrier in that relationship, because now this lie must be maintained.
Mm-hmm.
And if the other person realizes it's a lie, now it's like, you know, what else have you told me that's a lie?
Mm. Okay, so when we get that question and we're looking for a deeper relationship with the other person, how do we tackle it?
Well, and that's one of the points I try to make about in the book, which is, there's real skill involved in handling these ethical situations. So at a simple level, one thing you can do is say, well, Mom, why do you ask?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So it's a, and I wouldn't call that a deceptive response. I would call that a response where you're really trying to understand what your mother's asking you in the situation. So that's, I mean, it doesn't take a lot of skill, but there's some, if you will, techniques you can use to really understand what's going on in the situation. And then beyond that, if you want to transform the situation, and in my mind, you know, if Mom's asking me, does she look fat in this dress, my guess is she's probably asking me something more like, do you love me?
Hmm.
Or there's something like that that might be going on. And if I can find out through a conversation with my mother what's really going on, I can now address the real issue as opposed to just trying to avoid an uncomfortable situation.
Hmm. You know, we do these kinds of things without thinking about it so often, and I guess that's where we get into trouble, and I guess that's a good reason to have written this book, to get us to think about what we're doing and the consequences of our actions. And one of the things that was interesting to look at in Ethics for the Real World is all the ways we talk about lying and deception, all the words we use. So why does lying play such a big role in our lives? Big lies, little lies.
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with not being willing to step up to the hard work of developing relationships a lot of times. So I look at lies as a way of making things easier in the short term. You know, so like the white lies, or, you know, somebody phones up and you don't want to take their phone call, and so you tell your secretary, oh, tell them I'm in a meeting, when you're really not.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you've just made life easier for yourself,
mm-hmm.
but you've done it in a way that, in my mind, you know, certainly has not advanced the relationship. It's not solved the problem. I mean, it's not like this person, if you don't want to talk to them, they're not going to call back. And so you've just kind of, you've gone for short-term expediency at the expense of long-term, I would call it character, because I think ultimately this stuff comes back to you, and relationships. And I think one of the problems in this, too, is that people have this notion that, or a lot of folks have this notion that it's just a small thing.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't really matter. And, you know, in a lot of cases, you know, that may be true. But the problem is, lots of little things start to add up into habits. And it's in the practice of these daily ethical situations that you develop your habits of how you want to think about, how you think about ethics, and how you act in ethically sensitive situations. So that's really what I'm concerned about, is how do you build good ethical habits that will serve you well in your life?
So that's why you suggest we draft an individual personal code to guide our decision making. So where and how do we begin?
Well, so there are, so the book outlines a number of places you can begin, but I'd say the first place to begin is there's three basic areas in my mind where most ethically sensitive situations show up. There, first is truth-telling, the second is stealing, and the third is hurting. And most of the ethically sensitive situations we run across in life falls into one of those three buckets. And so in terms of drafting your code, I think one good question to ask yourself is, where am I willing, for most people, by the way, they say, you know, yeah, don't lie, don't steal, don't hurt other people. Mm-hmm. That's pretty easy to sign up for, and I think most people do so.
Yeah.
The rub comes in what exceptions are you willing to make to these? So, for example, under truth-telling, are you willing to lie to save someone's feelings? Are you willing to lie to avoid punishment or to get ahead financially? So, I mean, these would be, if you will, exceptions to the basic notion of don't lie. And in terms of creating your ethical code, it's really a matter of, well, when am I willing to make an exception to this general principle of lying, mm-hmm, or not stealing or harming? And I think that's a pretty good place to start.
Yeah.
And here's why I think it's so valuable. When most people are confronted with an ethically sensitive situation, you're walking into a meeting with a customer and your boss pulls you aside and says, we can't deliver the product when we promised, but don't tell the customer that. What do you do?
Mm-hmm.
You want to do right by your customer. You also want to do right by your boss, and you're just about to walk into the meeting. And so if you don't have something to fall back on, it's very difficult in the moment to figure out what kind of person you want to be. It's time pressured. It's often emotional. It catches you by surprise. And there's a number of decision traps that have been identified in terms of just how people fall into traps when making decisions. And in these situations when you're surprised and time pressured, you're the most prone to the rationalizations and other forms of traps that you fall into from making decisions. And so an ethical code basically gives you something to fall back on when you're in these caught-by-surprise situations.
Hmm. Have you been caught in such a situation?
I have been. Well, so I don't know if caught in my mind means unprepared.
Yeah.
But I've certainly been in situations where people have asked me to do things that I've said no under ethical circumstances. So for example, I raised venture capital for one of my companies. And when you raise venture capital, so long as the company's going well, the venture capitalist lets you do whatever you want. And then when things go poorly, and this was in 2001 when the dot-com crash happened, so things were going poorly for my company, they stepped in and they said, Clint, I know you like to tell all your employees about your financial situation, but you have to stop doing that. Because if they realize you're in difficult financial straits, they might leave the company. And to which I responded, well, maybe they need to leave the company. If they can't take the risk of being in a startup company, I mean, that's the kind of relationship I want to have with my employees, where they're making free and informed choices about their employment. And basically what they said is, nope, from our point of view, the first time they should realize that you're having financial difficulties is when they come to work and the doors are locked. Because if they know about it any time beforehand, they might leave and that would be bad for you.
Hmm.
And in my mind, that was unacceptable. I did not want to convey to my employees that we were financially well off when in fact we weren't.
Yeah. Well, how honest are you then in that situation with your employees? Do you want to buffer that message a little bit?
See, I would argue don't buffer it at all.
Okay.
And so this is a personal preference, by the way, from a prudential point of view. But in my mind, I've been through a number of difficult financial situations with employees before.
Uh-huh.
And as soon as you, quote unquote, buffer it,
uh-huh,
basically to employees, this starts to smell like bullshit. All right. They know something's going on that you're not quite telling them. And so they can imagine then all things that are substantially, could be substantially worse than what's really going on. And I found, so before this situation with a venture capitalist, and before I took VC money and I was managing everything on my own, there were times when I could not pay my employees' salary. Matter of fact, I went through 90 person months of not being able to pay salary in a couple of different times. And through that period of time, I only lost one person. So everybody stuck with me, even though they couldn't get paid for as much as 3 months in a row sometimes. And that one person was a single mother who was our office manager who couldn't take the risk.
Yeah.
So we helped her find another job.
Yeah.
But through that, because I was completely honest with them, and oh, by the way, I mean, completely honest also means there's some kindness that has to go along with it. It doesn't mean saying, oh, by the way, we're out of money. You guys might not get paid ever again.
Hmm.
I mean, that would be the unskillful way of being honest. I think a more skillful way is to say, like, so 2 months before it looked like we weren't being able to pay people's salaries, I said, here's the deal. You know, it looks like we're going to run into a financially difficult time. The very first month, the founders, myself included, are going to stop taking salary. The next month, all the rest of the executives, all the vice presidents, are going to stop taking salary. And in month number three, if we still haven't turned things around, then all employees are going to stop taking salary. And then as soon as we turn things around, either through customer sales or raising more venture money, I will do my best to pay back that back salary, and will either be in cash or in stock. So I was very clear up front about what was going to happen, and basically I made sure that the folks that have the most to gain, namely the founders and the executives, also felt the most pain in the situation. And so I found by the time you go through a couple of experiences like this, which are not uncommon for startup companies, you have an incredibly cohesive team who is willing to go through all kinds of other challenges with products or customers or competitors and so forth. And so we had great relationships having gone through these ethically sensitive situations.
Yeah, I bet everybody then is really pulling. You're all pulling on the, you know, for one another and for the organization as a whole.
Right. And you have this, I would call this, you build a feeling of authenticity. So we're going to be really authentic with you. And so folks know that basically they're going to have an opportunity to get heard. They're going to get the information that they need to make decisions. That's another aspect to this. When you're in the startup world, and people join you, they know there's a lot of risk involved.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a dangerous, if you will, situation, especially for people with families and mortgages and so forth. But they take it, you know, hoping to understand all the risks and being in a position to be able to manage that. And the worst thing I think you can do to people in that situation is deceive them or not give them the information. And so they can't understand the risks, and so they don't know basically, the decisions they're making are not fully informed.
Mm.
So from my point of view, I feel like I have an obligation, at least to my employees, to keep them fully informed, and so they all know that they're in a position to make high-quality decisions for themselves.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Clinton Korver. He is co-author with Ronald Howard of Ethics for the Real World, Creating a Personal Code to Guide Decisions in Work and Life. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. We also have a toll-free number, that number 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now, a listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hey, I've got a comment, basically, and that is, I think some of the problems with society is due to hypocrites, such as it doesn't matter what political party you're from, but when one party in power says you shouldn't do this, and then when they flip and they get in power, they do exactly what the other, you know, what they said that they should, you know, the other party should not do. It just seems like when you don't have confidence in the people at the top, then it just trickles down to everybody tends to just say, well, it doesn't really matter. And we all, or the society tends to lose a little bit of its ethics because of that. I'll get off the line and listen. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call.
So I think your call in makes a great point in that a lot of this ethics and, if you will, the culture of ethics starts at the top. So at Stanford, we teach a class on basically just ethical, helping students create an ethical code. And one of the things that the students often don't appreciate when they're taking their first job is how important ethics in that company and whether or not they're aligned with their personal ethics. I mean, they're just not sensitive to that issue. And this is often not hard to find out. You look at the top of the organization, you find out what are they willing to, if you will, get away with, or what are they, what kind of standards do they set for themselves? Because as you go down in an organization, it only gets more lax most of the time. So to the extent there's, if you will, problems at the top of the organization, there's likely to be even bigger problems lower down in an organization.
Is the guest still there? I think we have a problem. Mr. Corver, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here. I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, for a minute there, you dropped out.
Oh, sorry about that.
Not a problem.
So
So look at the top of the organization, and then that's going to give you a good idea of what's going on throughout the organization.
Right, and I think in particular when you have a decision of whether or not to join an organization, I would say this is very important information to uncover.
I want to the caller talked about a little bit about politics. And, you know, politics has been described as the art of compromise. When is compromise compromised by deception?
Well, so I would say there's nothing wrong with compromise.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, that's a necessary way that the world works. But the I would draw the line at deception. So you can say, for example, I don't like this, but I'm going to vote for it. And here's why.
Mm-hmm.
And it's when you say that, you know, it's when you don't tell the truth, or you only tell a portion of the truth in what's going on, that things start to become ethically sensitive in my mind. So ethics is not about getting what you want. It's about doing what's right. And you can do what's right and not necessarily get what you want. You don't get that promotion necessarily, or you don't get the bill passed that you want. And that's not ethical in my mind, or ethically sensitive.
Yeah.
So here's actually, I'd say there's an important distinction to make in terms of thinking about ethics. Whenever you make a decision, there are three dimensions to the decision. There's the ethical dimension, which is what's right or wrong. There's a prudential dimension. Think of that as what's financially in my best interest or profitability. And then there's the legal dimension, which is what's prescribed by society. And oftentimes, ethical situations get complicated because prudential and legal things all get mixed in together. So for example, in take Madoff example.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, he certainly lied to people. It was also illegal what he did. But you could say, at least for him for a while, it was prudential.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not prudential now because, you know, now it looks like he's going to end up in jail and he's going to lose all his assets and so forth. But if you sort of peel this apart and say, well, what's just the ethical component? And this was pretty clear. It's pretty clear that it's, I mean, there's some real deception going on. But for, like, some students in our classes, for example, they get very concerned about, well, should I take a job in the city or in the country? And they think this is ethical because it just feels so important to them. But there's no ethical dimension there necessarily unless there's, you know, back to the big three, unless there's some truth-telling, stealing, or harming compromise in play.
So when you're thinking about where you are and what is ethical, you want to set aside those kind of issues, prudential issues.
So I would recommend for making a decision, if it's ethically sensitive, the very first thing to do is separate out the legal issues, the prudential issues, and just think about the ethics of the situation. Now, to ultimately make the decision, you have to bring back in prudential and legal. But to think about them all at once at the beginning makes things unnecessarily confusing.
Okay. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Clinton Korver, co-author of Ethics for the Real World, Creating a Personal Code to Guide Decisions in Work and Life. Well, maybe what we could do here is go back to something that we touched on a little bit earlier, and that is drawing up your own ethical code, your personal code. Because if we go back to thinking about this big picture, you know, a lie may be ethical. It may be ethical to take something that belongs to another without asking. It may be ethical to harm another, perhaps, in self-defense, for example. Mm-hmm. So how do we prepare for those times when what ordinarily would be wrong might be the right choice? How do we begin to think through our personal code, drawing up our personal code?
So I think there's a couple of ways to start. One is to think back in your previous in your life and say, when have I encountered an ethically sensitive situation?
Mm-hmm.
And say, in those situations, how did I behave, and then how do I want to behave? So it may be, and what we found in when we asked people this question, they can recall ethically sensitive situations that happened years ago as if they've happened yesterday.
Yeah.
So, I mean, these are the things that stick with you that you worry about. And these are great places to start thinking about your ethical code. It reminds me, actually, I saw an article a couple of months ago about Katie Couric. So she was giving an interview, and she had a confession to make. And her confession was that 45 years ago, in elementary school, she plagiarized. She wrote a poem uh-huh. that was not her own, and it got published in her elementary school booklet or whatnot.
Uh-huh.
And she came clean. And for 45 years, she was carrying that around with her. And her remarks was how good it felt to finally get that off her chest.
Yeah.
And, I mean, this is an example of how these, you know, what seems like a small thing, I mean, elementary school, you know, it just stays with you.
Yeah.
So this is often the best place to start in thinking about your ethical code.
Yeah. Let's take another call now. A listener in Chicago, line 4, good afternoon. Line 4, Chicago?
Yes, I'd like to point out that it isn't not too long of a time when a travesty becomes a tragedy, and not only do we have that occurring now with the economic disaster that's existing around the world, but then we have the other matters of the wars that were entered into because of false premises, and then we have the matter of going back to some of the biblical statements about the golden rule and do not do to others that which you would not want done to you. And some of these things are for the good, like the golden rule and so forth, and others become creative enterprise like Enron and so forth. So we can go on the line somehow or other, the evoking the idea of ethics is tossed to the wind on the part of those who are given responsibilities for guidance and leadership in the country. So I just thought I'd throw that in case you want to comment about how vast the situation has become and what more education or preaching might be necessary to get to a more peaceful ethical consideration on our part. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for the call. Nice points.
Yeah, it's all too easy to, I mean, literally every day you can pick up the paper and you can find ethically sensitive examples left and right. It reminds me of Warren Buffett had a quote, basically he said, it's only when the tide goes out that you learn who's been swimming naked. And we got a lot of naked swimmers right now in the financial industry.
Yeah. Well, there was a really interesting op-ed piece in the New York Times yesterday. Frank Rich wrote it. And the title of the piece, What We Don't Know Will Hurt Us, and one of the things he says here is, for all the gloomy headlines we've absorbed since fall, we still can't quite accept the full depth of our economic abyss either. Nicole Gelinas, a financial analyst at the conservative Manhattan Institute, sees denial at play over a wide swath of America, reaching from the loftiest economic strata of Wall Street to the foreclosure-decimated boom developments in the Sun Belt. And then he goes on to write, "Pity our new president as he rolls out one recovery package after another. He can't know for sure what will work. If he tells the whole story of what might be around the corner, he risks instilling fear itself among Americans who are already panicked. But if the president airbrushes the picture with too much, the country could be angry about ensuing calamities."
So I guess my response to that would be the same response I have to the employees of my company,
yep.
Which is, if you don't tell the full story, people will know that, and they will imagine horrors far worse than reality in terms of what's not being told to them.
Yeah. How do you think the president has done so far? He said, "Well, we don't know if this is going to work or not, but we got to do it." And I think he's been praised by some people for that and criticized.
Well,
by
I mean,
some.
So I give him credit for the forthrightness of "we don't know if this is going to work."
Yeah,
and I think it's a lot of these government interventions. It's there's unintended consequences, so you don't know what that might be. So I think, any time there's, especially at this kind of level, we don't know what the unintended consequences are going to be. And, it might fix unemployment, but it might make inflation, say, terrible. I mean, just back on the politics, it was kind of like I think he could have done a better job on some of his basically vetting of his cabinet choices.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The whole notion of, basically, cabinet choices not paying their taxes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's such a, in this kind of climate, it's such a volatile sort of issue.
Yeah, and you wonder, those people should have stepped forward right away and said, "Well, Mr. President, I might have a problem here for you."
And should have stepped forward, and you'd think that these are very public, very important kinds of positions, and you'd think President Obama's team has been vetting these folks quite a while and would have a good feel for how that would come across. And, to President Obama's credit, it came off and he said, "Okay, I screwed this one up." So I think that also, taking responsibility for your actions, in my mind, does a lot to help recover from these kinds of circumstances.
Yeah. Let's take another call. A listener in Elburn, Illinois, line one. Hi.
Yeah, good afternoon. Hello.
Hi there.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay, great. If we had ethics to begin with, I mean real ethics, that the government would stand behind and the banking system would stand behind, maybe wouldn't be in this spot in the first place. But I've seen times where if they don't like the ethics right now, they'll change it. I actually saw this not too long ago, and I'm trying to remember when it was. Within the last 6 months, they decided, well, that's not good. It had to do with I think it was Countrywide or somebody that went under an ethical situation, or unethical situation the way they did it. And, now they realize there was a problem. We should have fixed it. And, well, I've been hearing this, and I've been listening to the stock market guys and all these other people who, by the way, still thinks we're not in a depression or a recession. They think that it was just a slowdown in the market. So that tells me one thing, that these people know nothing, and the rules and regulations that we put down for, as far as the government is concerned, there is no ethics, because I really do see them changing it to fit their lifestyle. Am I not correct? Both on the national and the federal. I mean, the national and the state.
State, okay.
So this is an interesting point. It reminds me of there's a Buddhist saying about, if you want to become a monk, it's much easier to do this if you're hanging around other monks than people who are not on the path to enlightenment. And I think of like the banking situation and Countrywide and so forth. Here you have, well, first of all, I'd say the feedback loops were broken. So people are selling mortgages that are not high quality risks, selling them off to Wall Street, and the banks don't experience the consequences of their poor decision-making. And now, back to the Buddhist point, you're in this whole system where everybody is all about the short-term dollar. as opposed to the long-term consequences. And everybody feeds off each other. And so I would argue that this was fraught with ethical problems, and at its heart was a system where you have broken feedback loops and everybody in it feeding off each other, and it was, frankly, it was kind of destined for failure in some ways.
The listener want to follow up?
Yeah, I wanted to say that's the reason why this country is I turn it into a Walmart country. I mean, you know, I was there today, and I've never seen more people in a Walmart than I have today. And I live close to one, and the parking lots seems to be full versus going into a JCPenney's or a Sears or any place else. And the fact of the matter is, the honest guy, like myself and you guys, I'm assuming you are, that if you play by the rules, it tells you one thing. You're not respected. If you break the rules, if you do everything in your power to make it, you know, I guess that's the way I'm looking at it. It's just maybe it's the wrong way to look at it, but I've seen this go downhill for the last 30 years. And I think the 90s were the ones that started this greed, because that's when all the dot-coms were out there and the bubbles burst. And, I mean, it just got – everything's overvalued. And just to get honest dollar, it doesn't happen anymore. It's very difficult for an honest person to make a living anymore, and it seems like more and more people that break the rules get away with it. And that leads me to believe there is no ethics out there. But I'll get off. Thank you very much.
Okay.
So just in terms of reaction to that, so I would argue nice guys finished first.
Mm.
So and by first, I don't mean with the most dollars in your pocket by the time you die, but I mean first in terms of how you feel about yourself and the quality of the friendships that you have in the world. So you take somebody like a Madoff, for example. Now, here's a guy for decades had more dollars in his pocket than just about anybody else. But I would bet, I don't know this for sure, I haven't talked to him, but I would bet for decades he's been torn up internally about this. I mean, he was the one that came forward and said, hey, there's a problem here. I mean, it wasn't like he was uncovered by somebody else. So my guess is, internally, he felt pretty bad about this.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the day, he had all his friends that he lost their money. I mean, a lot of these folks lost their entire retirement accounts. So a lot of his friends feel betrayed by all this. So you know, the way I count success in life is by the story I tell myself about who I am and the kinds of friends and family I have around me. And, you know, I want financial success as much as the next guy, but in my mind, that's a means to an end, and it's a means to an end of having a quality life.
Yeah. Well, you know, when you use the phrase at the end of the day, also maybe it's useful to think, you know, if this was my last day, how would I feel about how I have lived?
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. I think that's a great – I would call that reframes the question. Helps you focus on what's important.
Yeah. One of the things that I got a kick out of in the book was, as you're questioning yourself, as you're thinking something over, you know, what would your mother say?
That's my mother's favorite, by the way, part of the book.
Yeah. What would mom say? And if mom says, what are you doing? You know, I think that just in a nutshell says so much. So let's take some more calls now. Let's go next to a listener on a cell phone, line 2. Good afternoon.
Hello. A couple questions for the guest.
Mm-hmm.
I like the concept of trying to write one's own personal ethical code. And I can imagine something as short as a paragraph or, you know, a complete manifesto. And so part one of the question is for the guest, how long is his manifesto and how long did it take him to, or paragraph, and how long did it take him to develop it? And two, there's a difference between figuring out what's right and doing the right thing. And sometimes it's, you know, difficult to make the right choice, even when you see what it is. And so I would just like his experiences in, you know, learning to, does having it help, and what has he done to help himself follow it better? That's it.
Okay.
So on the first bit, the size of the code, my personal code is about a paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and the reason it's so short is because I'm fairly categorical. I'm what I call a action-based person. I will not kill an innocent person regardless. I mean, you don't have to give me any of the story in terms of, you know, basically the benefits to society and any of the consequential sorts of things. I'm just not going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you want to be what I call an action-based person, where ethics is tied to the actions, not the consequences, then your code can be very short. I think for a lot of people, they would prefer to be what I would call a consequence-based person in terms of developing their ethical code. And both these have good philosophical bases for doing so. It's not like one is better than the other.
Mm-hmm.
But a consequence-based person, it's what they call utilitarians. They say, well, I won't lie except if the benefits are big enough. And the benefits might be helping the other person that's the receiving side of the lie. It might be improving your business. But whatever the story is, you say, if the benefits get to be big enough, then I think it's okay to lie. And so if you have that kind of code where you want to focus the ethics on the consequences, then codes can be quite long. And some students have 20 or 30-page codes because you have to define what kinds of benefits count enough such that I'm willing to, if you will, compromise the principle of not lie, don't steal, or don't harm.
Well, so, on that, how did, if you can answer that, how do you come to that conclusion, though? How do you say, I am the person who simply doesn't care what the consequences are? How does one arrive at being a completely ethics-based person? And I guess that's the nature of the question. It'd be very easy to project yourself into circumstances that are uncomfortable and say, yes, I have these rules and I'm going to follow them unless they put me in these uncomfortable circumstances. But it's more about the difficulty of choosing, even when the consequences can be bad or horrific even, or just, you know, unpleasant. That's kind of more what I'm getting at with the question.
Right. So in terms of, like, actually, you know, knowing what's right versus doing what's right, I think the more you understand about the implications of what you do, the easier it is to ultimately do what's right. So, for example, I would say that one of the steps in creating your code is to consult the touchstones. So think of the things that have been meaningful in your life where your values have come from, your parents, your family, your religion, your schools. And, I mean, there are people who have, for thousands of years, you know, very smart people, you know, people like Jesus and Buddha and Plato and so forth, have thought a lot about what it means to live a good life. And in my mind, that's what a lot of ethics gets to. And so I think, you know, the broader your perspective is on, you know, why is it that, you know, Jesus is saying things like the golden rule and, you know, Buddha is saying similar kinds of things and so forth. I mean, the more you understand that, and I think the more you internalize it, so think it through on your own, the easier it gets to be to do the right thing in addition to know the right thing. So let's go back to like a really simple example. My mom asked me if she's fat. In a lot of ways, that's a very challenging situation because I don't want to hurt my mom's feelings. I don't want to be unkind. But if I understand that here's an opportunity for me to deepen my relationship with my mother, and I have some confidence in my skills on handling that situation well, this now turns into an opportunity, and those kinds of thoughts about the relationship and skills and so forth ultimately make it easier to do the right thing.
Let's take another call. A listener in Ottawa, line 4. Hi.
How you doing? I just had a question in regards to, it's an ethical question, I suppose. My cousin was valedictorian of his high school and, you know, overall just a very good student, a very good person in general. And he's attending UIC right now, and he has an internship and is making decent money. And, in regards to the legality of things, what is your stand on the ethics of the legalization of cannabis use or something like that, whereas prohibition with alcohol in the past was generally the same thing, where it was illegal, and then they realized that it wasn't working with the population. And, that's basically what my question is. Do you think that it's an ethical pastime or... In other words, would it be okay to do that? I'll just listen.
So let me put it in this way. So a lot of what I talk about is, how do you think about this from your own personal decision-making point of view? So if you were just choosing for yourself, you know, do I smoke marijuana or not? I get back to those three distinctions. You know, well, first of all, it's illegal. So if you've got a point of view about following the law, that plays into a point of view. There's the, is it ethical? So is it now, you know, if you're smoking marijuana, are you deceiving anybody? Are you stealing anything? Are you harming anybody? And there's certainly some of that activity can occur around that, but I would argue if you're not lying, stealing, or harming, then it's not ethically sensitive. But then there's a prudential issue. So prudential issue is, you know, basically, what are the health consequences for me doing this? You know, what are the, if I get caught, what are the, you know, I might end up in jail, I might end up with fines, I might, there's some, basically, some society might do some things to you that you find unpleasant. So in making that decision, you would need to consider all three dimensions to come up with a high-quality decision.
Okay. We've got to wrap up here this afternoon, and I've got a couple of other callers I can't get in this afternoon. But one of the things I wanted to ask you about, and I thought this was really interesting, in the question and answer that was supplied by the publisher in, together with this book, Ethics for the Real World, there was a question, did you find any surprising data from your research? And one of the surprises that the two of you had, apparently, is that few organizations focus on the individual and how they make decisions. And in the answer, you say, all ethical decisions are fundamentally individual. Organizations do not deceive. Within organizations, with that as a background here, should organizations, businesses, institutions of education, and so on and so forth, should, as part of the training and the development of staff, should there be the effort put into creating personal codes among employees?
So from my point of view, I think that would be a far more effective way of ethics training than what is currently done.
Yeah.
So currently people say, here are the things that we stand for as a company. You know, don't take gifts from vendors.
Right.
And they've got a whole list of these sorts of things. But the problem with that is, as we mentioned, it comes across ink for themselves. So from my point of view, the core of ethics is thinking clearly about ethically sensitive situations. And so just taking on somebody else's code, even a set of religion, like the Ten Commandments or something, in my mind, that does not serve you nearly as well as thinking this through for yourself and coming to your own conclusions what's right and wrong for you.
Yeah.
So if in the organization all the employees came up with their own personal ethical codes, and then you basically had a discussion, it's like, okay, how do these things fit together? My hunch is some individuals would say, boy, you know what? This is not the right organization for me. It is just too close to doing things that for me is personally unacceptable. But I think ultimately that would make the organization stronger to be having those kind of conversations.
Yeah. There, we've got to leave it. We're out of time. Mr. Korver, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Celeste, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me on your show.
Clinton Korver is co-author with Ronald Howard of Ethics for the Real World, Creating a Personal Code to Guide Decisions in Work and Life. The book is published by the Harvard Business Press. It's 1:54. Let's find out what happened today in Kansas City and Chicago at the Boards of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. What happened there was really following what happened in New York today with the Dow Jones Industrial Average. It did dip below its 2002 low today, but managed at this point at least to stay above that. And it must have been that way just as we went into the close, because there was some green, at least in the corn and the bean pit. But the wheat pit made a loss today, down 8.75 in the March contract to 5.20. 28.25 top today for the March wheat from the soft red pit in Chicago. A low of 508.75, the settlement price at 510.5, 8.75 cents the loss. May futures 521.5, down 9 cents today. The high at 39.25, the low at 20. And July contract 550.75, the high, the low at 32.25, settlement price at 533.5. July soft red winter wheat, a loss today of 8.75 cents. September futures down 8.25, a 569.5 top, bottom at 56, settled at 556.75, down 8.25. In Kansas City, the loss was 8 cents with a hard red nearby March contract at $5.48.25. From the corn pit in Chicago, futures were a bit higher, 359.75 the high, the low at 49.5 for the March contract. The settlement price for the futures at 351.75 on the lead option, a penny and a half higher for the day. May futures 368.5 the high, the low at 58.25. Settlement price at $3.60.75, up 1.75 in July. 378.25 the high, the low at 68. Settlement price at $3.70.75, up 2.25. September 384.5 the high, the low at 77.5. Settlement price at $3.80, up 2.25. In December futures, 399.25 the high, the low at 89.25. Settlement price at 391.5. December corn futures up 1.75 today. March oat futures, $1.77, 8.5 cents higher. The May up 8.5 as well at $1.86.5. Soy complex now. March beans, 894.5 the high, low at 860.75. Settlement price at 872.75, up 10.25. May 895.75 on the high, the low at 61.25. Settlement price at $8.76, up 12.75. July futures 899.75 the high, the low at 67.75. Settlement price at $8.82.25, 13 cents higher in the August contract. 877.5 the high, the low at 65. Settlement price at $8.75, up 11.5 cents. November beans 855.5 the high, the low at 30.25. Settlement price at $8.40, up 9.5 cents. March bean meal futures 279.90 the high, low at 268.60. Settlement price $276.30, up 6.30. And the May meal 273.30, up 6.10. The March bean oil 9 cents the gain at 30.31. And the nearby May futures at 30.62, up 9 as well. I'll return at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock Central with the closing market report. I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Mike Morris in McHenry at 815-344-7213. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Let's turn our attention now to livestock contracts and what happened there in Chicago at the Mercantile Exchange today. February live cattle, 81.40, the high 80.50, the low, the settlement 81.10, that up 42.5. April, 84.30, the high 83.10, the low 83.92.5, the settlement, that up 50. June, 82.30, the high 81.15, the low 81.85, the settlement, that up 30. August, 82.65, the high, the low 81.40, the settlement 82.20, that up 42.5. March feeder cattle 89 even, the high 87.60, the low 88.75, the settlement that up 37.5. April 90.40, the high 88.95, the low 89.67.5, the settlement at down 15. May 92.30, the high 90.65, the low, the settlement 91.72.5, up 7.5. April lean hogs, 58.60 the high, 58 even the low, the settlement 58.22.5, up 27.5. May, 69.70 the high, 69 even the low, 69.60 the settlement, that up 10. June, 71.45 the high, 70.47.5 the low, the settlement 70.95, down 2.5. July, 72.25 the high, 71.45 the low, 71.95 the settlement, that up 37.5. And February belly, 77.40 the high, the low, 77.40 the settlement, 77.40. That says that was up 1.40. The Dow is currently off 204 points at 71.61. The Nasdaq is off 44 points at 13.97, and the S&P 500, forgive me, is down 22 at 7.48. Nearby crude at the Mercantile Exchange in New York, down 54 cents at 38.94. It's 2 o'clock. This is WILL5.